I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. In 2015, the combined scrap metal industries in the U.S. were said to be worth close to $40 billion. That's incentive enough to find, collect, and bring metals to local dealers to get a piece of that pie. It also has developers, as well as building and car owners, complaining that it encourages theft. We'll examine a proposed ordinance the Kansas City, Missouri City Council is considering to curb the trade in illegally gotten metal. Then we'll examine race and racism by looking at how white kids growing up with privilege learn about these issues. How they are taught could change or perpetuate the narrative when it comes to racial inequality. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Who knew that the scrap metal business could be so controversial? But it is, and one lawyer calls it the single largest cause of blight in the urban core. That's because people eager for quick cash are so willing to tear out metal from older homes, from churches, and from cars. In the process, they effectively render those homes or cars useless. If you're a scrap metal dealer in Kansas City, things might be changing for you, and soon, if a proposed city ordinance that seeks to tighten the rules and regulations around this industry gets city council approval. We'll find out what the proposed changes are and what this industry is like here in Kansas City right now. With us is KCUR reporter Sam Zeff. He's been following this issue for us here at the station. Sam, always good to have you. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
How big a problem has the scrap metal industry turned out to be in Kansas City? Your story quoted a Kansas City lawyer who said this is the single largest cause of blight in the urban core. That's quite a statement.
It is, and there was any number of people from the historic Northeast District, but all over the urban parts of Kansas City, who came to testify to say, you know, there are abandoned houses. People will go in there, strip out copper wiring, strip out copper pipes, take those to scrap metal dealers. And if you're trying to rehab that home, it's already expensive enough to try to bring it up to code. But now if you have to rewire the whole house, or if the utilities hadn't been turned off and now it's flooded because the copper pipe has been pulled out, you've got a very expensive proposition. And there's a good chance that that house is going to sit empty because of the expense of bringing it back up to code.
So given all this, Mayor Pro Tem Scott Wagner is proposing this ordinance to curb the selling of scrap metal. Can you tell us about some of the regulations he's hoping to put into place here to curb all this?
Yeah, so the ordinance that there was a hearing on a couple of weeks ago, it has been delayed. The scrap metal industry came forward and said, you know, we didn't get very much advance notice about this. So they've been meeting, trying to negotiate something in some differences in the ordinance. Right now, the ordinance that has been put forward would prohibit scrap metal dealers from making cash payments. So if you bring scrap to the yard, you're going to get either a check or a debit card, something, a financial instrument that you can that can be tracked. You're going to wait 3 days for that payment, and you're going to be limited to one trip per day per scrap yard. Now, the industry.
And the point of this is what?
To cut down on illegal scrap being brought in. So there's a lot of legitimate purposes for these recycling yards, right? So, for example, when they raise KCI, there's a lot of stuff there that is recyclable. There's going to be metal and there's going to be other things. And what the industry says is you can't limit somebody who's there, a contractor doing a job that big, to one delivery a day because there are tons of that. The other thing is that their quote was, "Who makes anybody wait 3 days for a payment?" Hmm. Right? You bring in, you know, you legitimately bring in a car or whatever. Why should you have to wait 3 days to get payment for that transaction? The pushback, of course, is there is a lot of illegal scrap coming in. There's stolen cars coming in to scrap yards, and they're desperately trying to cut back on that.
This business must be fairly lucrative if the problem is as great as it appears to be.
Yes, millions of dollars, actually. And, of course, it fluctuates depending on the price of copper or whatever else, whatever non-ferrous metal. Non-ferrous metal, of course, is, anything that doesn't have iron or steel into it. So there's times if there is a shortage of copper, well, the price of that copper goes way up. Nickel, anything like that. So it is very lucrative business. And in some ways, there's a lot of businesses that are running simply a cash business with little or any ability of law enforcement or regulators in the state of Missouri to track those transactions.
So by waiting 3 days, how does that help cut down on the notion that some of this metal might be being stolen?
Well, I think that what it does is that if you're stealing copper pipe or copper wire out of a house, you may have an immediate need for that money, whatever that need may be. And that if you have to wait for that money,
it might discourage you from doing it the first place.
It is a disincentive to do that thievery.
So, is this a particular problem for the area that Scott Wagner represents? Again, he's the councilman working on this issue. He's up north in the 1st District. What's he up against up there?
Not much, really. Most of this happens in the urban core. That's where most of these scrap metal yards are. So, and he's been working on this scrap metal issue for a number of years. There was an ordinance 3 or 4 years ago. He was involved in that. I think that he, as he said in the hearing, wants to do good by some of these neighborhoods that are suffering through some of this because of this scrap stealing.
And what was the response that he received and the council received at its session that when they took up this issue?
Well, residents were four square behind it. They couldn't be any happier that however you can tighten down these scrapyard regulations, there's nothing too tight for most of these residents. The industry is fighting back. They say that, you know, mostly they're good citizens, that there are that they are, in fact, providing a service to recycle this metal. So now they're at loggerheads. That's why the ordinance was postponed. They hope to get everybody into a room and come up with something that everybody can live with.
Did you have a note in your story, Sam, about this idea that even thieves will go into churches or on the roof of churches and take a metal they can find up there? They're so desperate to get this stuff.
That was some of the testimony that that people in some neighborhoods will just go under the roof, undo the air conditioning units, throw it off the roof, haul it to a scrap metal yard.
We're talking about the scrap metal industry in Kansas City and what a scourge it can be for residents. Sam Zeff of the KCUR Newsroom is here with me. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Has law enforcement had a reaction to these proposed changes, Sam?
Oh, yeah. Both the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department and the Missouri Highway Patrol were at this hearing a couple of weeks ago. The Missouri Highway Patrol says that car thefts in the city of Kansas City has gone up 61% since 2011. In 2012, the General Assembly changed a law that said you don't need a title to an automobile to bring it to a scrapyard if it's 10 years old or older and it's inoperable. Now, inoperable could mean that they took a tire off, right? Mm-hmm. So now it's inoperable.
Right.
And so the Highway Patrol suggests that that there are unscrupulous tow people around who will go and see a car that is broken down on the side of a highway, hook it up, take it to a tow yard. If it's 10 years old or older, it's already inoperable. They can turn it in without any title, get cash money for that. And then the scrap yard, the key here is taking it to a scrap yard that shreds the automobile. So you might be familiar with some yards that just stamp them flat. In that case, law enforcement can still poke around and maybe find a vehicle identification number on the car. There are several locations on a car where you can find a VIN. If you put it through a shredder, you literally end up with just a big pile of small pieces of metal, and it's impossible to track. So car thefts go up. The Missouri Highway Patrol blames that piece of legislation, not only for car thefts going up in Kansas City and Missouri, but around neighboring states as well. KBI statistics show that since 2009, car thefts in Kansas have almost doubled.
God, that's just amazing. Again, who knew that scrap metal could be such a scourge on society? 816-235-2888 is our number. How big a problem do we have out there in Kansas City? You can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Scott from Kansas City, Kansas, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. I would just like to make a quick point that in my neighborhood in KCK, I can put metal trash out on the curb, and that stuff is gone within hours.
Yeah. Sam?
Yeah, you know, that's a very interesting point. This is not my first rodeo with scrap metal. Any number of years ago, I did an investigation when I was at the Fox station in Philadelphia, where there were scrap yards that actually ran 24 hours a day. And part of our sting was we put recyclable metal out on people's porches or stoops. People would come by 2, 3 o'clock in the morning, grab that metal up, take it right to a scrap yard in the middle of the night, and come away with cash. So this is clearly a problem that is in many, many urban areas.
Thanks for the call, Scott. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Let's go to David from Kansas City, Missouri. Again, our topic, scrap metal. Our number, 816-235-2888. David, you're on the air.
I scrap a couple of times a week. I take metal down there because I'm a plumber and a contractor. And just, I think that it's really going to do a lot of damage to the homeless population because that's their number one income. And I don't really see it as the number one cause of blight in the city. I've been on a lot of jobs that I've had it happen to me, but it's just not that prevalent.
Huh. So what do you think is going to happen with the homeless then, David? What's going to be the effect?
Actually, I mean, it's you're taking away the number one source of income for a large portion of the homeless and the poor people. So it's going to, it's going to take their number one income away.
Yeah, I'm glad you're called. So, Dave, you're not crazy about this ordinance then, doesn't sound like.
No, not really. I think, you know, they put an ordinance in so that air conditioning, when you scrap an A-coil, you have to have a license, which I have. And it just didn't do anything. It doesn't help.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
David, thank you for the call. What's the council heard about what this impact could do to the homeless population, as our caller just pointed out?
Yeah, they really didn't discuss that at the at the hearing. But just like every problem, isn't it intertwined with everything else? So you will, in fact, take away people's livelihood. I did talk to one woman there who said she was a truck driver, although during slow periods that she scraps. She's a scrapper, as they say. And she said, you know, that's how I feed myself. So clearly, it's going to be an issue. And so what are the unintended consequences? You would hope that the council, the industry, neighbors are talking about that as they negotiate this ordinance.
And just to wrap up a loose end here, this proposed ordinance will, in fact, address car scrapping, Sam?
In a very minor way. So what the ordinance would do is it would require the scrapyard to photograph the automobile, right? So there would be some additional paper trail, but they can't change the law. There seems to be not an appetite in the General Assembly right now for that. And I don't even know if the Missouri Highway Patrol wants to lobby the legislature to change that at this point. So they're trying to address the stolen car issue, but it doesn't require a title. They can't change state law. It would require a little bit more documentation with a photograph.
Let's go back to some calls. And David from Kansas City, Missouri. David, you're on the air.
Awesome. So, yeah, I just had a question. Is it illegal for them to go in, strip out the copper and the metals from inside of abandoned houses? And then what can we do to prevent that? Because we've already had in my neighborhood one house get burnt down by squatters in it. I don't know if they're stripping it. but it did burn to the ground, and they ended up demolishing it. I don't know if maybe demolishing a house would be a better thing going around than maybe trying to pass more legislation about it.
Sam?
Yeah, so one of the issues with the Kansas City Fire Department that they talked about at the hearing was that when you strip out copper wire, it is only worth money when you are able to get the insulation off of it. So the Kansas City Fire Department has said that they've had to respond to any number of fires in abandoned homes where people have stripped out the copper wire, set a fire in the house to burn off the insulation, and then the fire spreads. The fire department also says, by the way, they've had a number of fire hydrants vandalized for that metal.
And KCP&L pointing out they've lost $100,000 in copper wire this year. That's a lot of copper wire.
Just this year, $200,000 last year.
Yeah. David, thanks for the call. Let's go to Keaton from Kansas City, Missouri. Keaton, good morning.
Hi there, Steve. I was just wanting to comment real quick. I work for an apartment company up here in Midtown, and just touching on having a scrapper around, we've got a couple guys that we use when we have, like, dishwashers or fridges, and I was just going to say, sometimes it's really helpful to have those people, but then when they drive around and you don't have anything, sometimes it seems like certain things go missing and they weren't designated to.
Yeah.
Undesignated scrap.
Yeah.
I think that's the illegal part of it. Clearly, there are these, as we talked about, these scrap yards do some good, right? They recycle metal from all different kinds of enterprises. It becomes a problem when they're unauthorized to do so.
I gather this is an issue in other cities, too.
Oh, yeah. I think that in a number of urban areas, it's a problem. Clearly, it was a huge problem in Philadelphia. It was a 24-hour-a-day problem of stealing scrap metal, taking it to the scrap metal dealer, and coming away with folded money.
Do any idea when this issue heads back to the city council for a vote? When are we going to get that?
Sometime after Labor Day. There is a date, but I have to tell you right now in my head, I can't remember it. But it's pretty soon. They've been trying to, I think there have been some ongoing talks with the industry, with Councilman Wagner, with people on the neighborhood and public safety committee. I mean, the committee was certainly interested in hearing from the industry. Not everybody is a bad actor. Not everybody is a bad actor. So there needs to be consideration for those scrap metal dealers who work above the law.
That's KCUR Sam Zeff talking about the problems in the scrap metal industry here in Kansas City and the damage that's being done. Sam, thanks so much. Appreciate it very much.
My pleasure, Steve.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about what white kids are learning about race. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. With over 20,000 names listed, Kansas has some of the most expensive criminal registries in this entire nation. Yesterday, we found out why and who's looking to cut them back. You can hear that conversation at kcur.org/up-to-date. Well, Professor Margaret Hagerman wanted to find out how upper-middle-class parents were teaching their white children about race. So she went to a medium-sized Midwestern city and spent 2 years observing 36 white boys and girls ages 10 to 13. And what she found may prove surprising. Here's one finding. Even in families where race was never discussed, the parents communicated all manner of ideas about race. Another conclusion, what parents say matters a whole lot less than what they do. And a third big idea, even progressive parents determined not to let bias into their homes often wind up reinforcing the very forms of inequality they so vehemently reject. Professor Hagerman outlines all of this in a new book, White Kids, Growing Up with Privilege in a Racially Divided America. She's an assistant professor of sociology at Mississippi State University, and she joins us from WMSV Studios there on campus. And Margaret, what a pleasure to have you. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, you found that of the families you observe, that they rarely talk openly about race. You also concluded that they should, and I'm wondering why.
So for some of the families in my study, they thought that if they talked about race with their children, then that would somehow make their children racist. And I think what's problematic about that is when I actually talked to their children and interviewed them, I found that their kids had all kinds of questions, anxieties, and also very, in my opinion, misguided ideas about race. And so by not talking about race, I think that they actually were, you know, kind of putting their children in a position to not be able to navigate a world where we know that race does, in fact, matter.
I was going to say, even in families that were determined to be anti-racist, you found that they actually reproduce and then reinforce forms of inequality that they say they reject. How do they do that?
So these are families, like you said, who really think of themselves as anti-racist and progressive, and they want to raise their children in a way so that their kids will challenge racism. And while they do that in some really powerful ways, they also provide their children with all kinds of advantages, and this is a result of both their economic privilege as well as their racial privilege. And so even parents that opt into the integrated public schools in this community, they simultaneously provided their children with all kinds of additional educational advantages and opportunities outside of school. And so I show how over and over, even these parents with these really great intentions of working against inequality are unintentionally reproducing this kind of inequality through the sort of transfer of advantage to their children.
Now, this is such a sensitive topic. I don't need to tell you that. I'm wondering, how did you get people to talk to you? How did you get families to let you into their lives, if you will, for a short time as you were doing your research?
One of the things that we know in social science research is that giving surveys to people can be very useful in some ways, but doesn't allow you to actually get some of the, you know, true ideas that they have, particularly with a sensitive topic like you mentioned of race. And so in order to really access their honest perspectives, I had to move to this community and build relationships and build rapport. And so I did that over the matter of 2 years. You know, it took a while to do this work, but through meeting some parents that were supportive of the project, and then they introduced me to other parents and children, and I was able to sort of build out from you know, a few parents that were very interested in the first place.
Were they suspicious?
Honestly, they weren't. I think many of them were surprised that I wanted to talk about race with them. In fact, many of the parents, you know, wanted to recommend their you know, black colleagues or their black friends for my project, which I thought was interesting, seeing as I was studying white families. But yeah, I don't know that they were suspicious. I think they were curious.
I gather you don't want to say which community it was.
No, I've decided to keep that information to myself. But I will say that the community I studied, I think, is like many communities in the United States. And so I think the actual location is less important than just sort of the processes that I observed taking place there.
How did you pick this particular community?
So this particular community has a sizable population of families who have what I would consider to be upper middle class status. And so meaning that they work in occupations that are considered professional occupations, they have very high levels of education, and they own a single family home, which we know is a great way to measure wealth. And so because there was a sizable population of these folks in this community, I thought that it would be great to study this community. In addition, I also knew that this community had some pretty big political divides. And so subsequently, I thought that that might be interesting to look at as well.
We're talking about how white kids learn about race. You selected families with kids in middle childhood. What age range are you looking at, and why did you want to observe kids and their families at that point in their lives?
So one of the things I try to do in my research is really be interdisciplinary and read widely. And so I know from child development literature that middle childhood is a time period. So this is really, I sort of selected a chunk of it. So the kids in my study are between the ages of 10 and 13. But this is a time period in which children are spending more time outside the home. They're starting to think in more ideological terms. They're able to think about other people in new ways. And so drawing on that developmental scholarship, I decided that that would be an interesting time period to study. Also, there's a lot of research about high schools and elementary schools, but there's not as much research about what goes on in middle school. And I think that's a really interesting period to study.
You know, you started off the book by saying that it seeks to examine white families with the intention of addressing critically the role that white families play in the production and reproduction of white racial power. Why did you take that approach?
Well, you know, when white parents draw upon their own race and class privileges to secure these advantages that I mentioned, like, you know, demanding that their child has the best math teacher or suing the school district when they don't like something that happened, using their professional networks to get their child an internship, they are ultimately participating in the reproduction of inequality. And so I think that when white parents, you know, use their power, their position of power to get more for their kids, this has an impact not only on their kids, but also on other children who have parents who don't have that same type of power. And so I know that these decisions are happening at the individual level, and they may seem unrelated to how our society is organized by race. But I think that we need to explore more carefully how these parenting decisions may ultimately reinforce larger forms of power and advantage.
If our listeners want to get involved in our conversation, we'd like to have you on this one. How do you talk about race with your own kids? How do you approach the topic? 816-235-2888 is our phone number. Again, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. You know, Margaret, you remind us that race is an invented political grouping disguised as a biological one. Explain that to me. What do you mean by that?
Sure. So oftentimes people think that race is a biological concept. But what we know from research is that race is instead a social concept. And the lines that demarcate different races were drawn by humans. And these lines were drawn in ways that ultimately relate to political projects. And so as a great philosopher, Charles Mills, puts it, you know, in this way, race is a political system. And so where you're located in that system or how you're categorized really shapes things like where you live, who you marry, how you see the world. And so ultimately, you know, I think that, you know, even when I teach classes on race, we spend time looking at how, you know, categories on the U.S. Census have shifted over time. We look at how racial classification systems in different parts of the world work differently. And so we know that race is a political system. It's not based in biology or DNA or anything like that.
It might not surprise people that you spend a lot of pages in this book looking at the school selections the parents made for their kids and why they made those selections. Let's look at some of the choices here. You know, with public schools, I'm wondering who was most likely to enroll in these? What were parents hoping their sons and daughters would gain from the experience of enrolling their children in a public school?
So because the parents in this project have lots of economic resources, they are able to make choices. And so for the parents that decided to keep their children in public school and not opt out, they were parents who told me that it was very important for their children to go to school with kids who were different than them, and that they did not want their children to go to school with kids that, you know, came from the same class background and their same racial background and so forth. And so these parents were the ones that I think, were, you know, they considered themselves to be more anti-racist and were trying to give their children experiences to learn about the experiences of other people and the opportunity to have interracial contact even at school.
Then there's private schools. What did you find out about the parents who were interested in enrolling their kids in those schools?
So many of these parents were first and foremost concerned with educational outcomes. They were very concerned about their children's future success. And so even though some of them also cared about their children having diverse experiences, they ultimately decided that it was more important for their children to have an elite educational experience. And what was interesting is I talked to the children, and certainly the kids who attended private school believed that they were smarter and more special and more likely to be a leader in the future in comparison to their public school peers.
Then there's Catholic schools. What did you find out about those parents?
So these parents had many different reasons for sending their children to the Catholic school. You might think it was due simply to religion, but I found out all kinds of other reasons, including things that sounded a little strange at the time, like one parent was concerned about the obesity epidemic and wanted to send her child to the Catholic school that happened to be located very close to her home. And in the book, I highlight how this is actually a much more complicated situation because she's trying to avoid her child being bused across town to a different school, and that busing system is directly connected to efforts to, you know, desegregate or integrate the school system. So sometimes I felt like the reasons parents were giving were an attempt to save face.
We're talking about how white kids learn about race. Margaret Hagerman is my guest. She's an assistant professor of sociology at Mississippi State University. Her new book, White Kids, Growing Up with Privilege in a Racially Divided America. Let's go to Whitney from Mission. Whitney, you're on the air.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you.
I was just calling in. I'm from Mission, and I have a little daughter, and she doesn't see any difference between races at all. She does notice some differences, but more so the similarities she has with children or people that are different than she is.
Mm-hmm.
And we took her to a swimming pool, and there was a little girl, a little African-American girl that had her hair colored red. And my daughter is a redhead, and she said she has hair like me. Hmm. We're the same.
Well, how do you approach these differences and explaining differences to your daughter, or do you, Whitney?
I explain that everybody has something to bring to the table, and if we all brought the same thing, it would be really boring.
Hmm. Differences
are important.
Any thoughts on that, Margaret?
Well, I think that absolutely differences are important. And I think that, you know, having those kinds of open conversations about difference rather than pretending, like some of the parents in my book, that everyone is the same and that kids don't even notice difference. I mean, that's part of what I'm pushing back at. I think that talking about difference with children is really important.
Okay. Whitney, I'm glad you called. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much, guys. Bye-bye.
Laura from Kansas City, Missouri, you're on Up Today. Good morning.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thank you, Laura.
Hey, I had a similar question. I've exposed my kids when they were younger to many different diverse opportunities. We live in suburbs of Kansas City where it's very similar looking to them. But I was really intrigued by having the actual conversation at that middle age that you were exploring, and maybe some kind of pointers or ways to begin that conversation with my kids as they're reaching that age.
What do you think, Margaret?
That's a really great question. And I will say, first and foremost, that there is a really great website called Embrace Race. And I think it's on Facebook. I think they also have a website. And they have all kinds of resources, and it's really pulled from a bunch of different scholars and child development experts and so forth, other parents, things that have worked for them. But I think that just really quickly, I think one strategy that seems to really work with children that are younger, but also in middle school, is talking a lot about fairness and talking, because kids really they tend to be very interested in things being fair. And I think that's one avenue through which you can sort of start to have these larger conversations about inequality, because sometimes talking only about difference and diversity and how, you know, wonderful it is to have a multicultural society, that's great. But sometimes we leave out then the part about inequality and the part about
right.
the real, you know, negative experiences that some kids might face.
Okay, that's wonderful. Thank you so much.
Good luck with it, Laura.
Thank you.
You know, Margaret, you write this in the book, understanding how white children produce, reproduce, and sometimes even reinterpret racial ideologies is central to larger understandings of how structures of white supremacy endure in a society such as ours. And I'm wondering, once we understand this, how do we use this understanding to change the narrative of racism in the country?
That's a really great question. I think we often just assume that the newer generations will be more, you know, tolerant and open-minded than the generations before.
Right.
And I think that, you know, there's actually some research on this, and there's sort of some mixed findings. I mean, one of the big findings that I think is important is that, you know, perhaps kids are not expressing the overt forms of racial stereotypes like we've had in the past. But sometimes there are other ways that prejudice is sort of like manifesting itself, like, you know, just like some of the kids, you know, just don't care about racism, you know, and not caring in some ways is also, you know, just, you know, similarly problematic to, you know, expressing overt sort of dislike or hostility. So I think that in terms of the future, we have to be more, I think that we should be more thoughtful about, you know, the messages that children are receiving through their social environments beyond just what we say to kids, sort of like how they interpret the world around them. And then thinking about interventions from levels of parents, but also maybe including schools and after-school programs and things like that.
What are we missing by not studying white families more closely when it comes to racial ideologies?
So I think that oftentimes, at least in social science research, the focus tends to be on families who are marginalized, in this case, racially marginalized. And that work is really important. However, I also think it's important to understand how people in positions of power are making sense of the world and how they're communicating with their children and how, you know, ultimately they're preparing their children for the future. And what we know is that when you grow up privileged, you know, as a child, you tend to then be in a powerful position as an adult. And so I think it's important to look at what, the, you know, sort of the dynamics that go on, particularly in these private spheres of white families, if we want to think about, you know, the future and sort of, you know, race relations and what they might look like.
You know, in Petersfield, that's the name of the town that you've used to describe the real city where you work. How did parents most often learn about the quality of the schools?
Well, it was very interesting to me because a lot of the research, the existing research documents that parents don't typically visit schools, that they're more often to use things like word of mouth. And this is, again, for families that have a lot of affluence. Mm-hmm. And what I found was that while some of the parents drew upon word of mouth, sort of reputation of school, you know, talking to other parents and getting information that way, there were some parents who were really serious and they, you know, they visited all the different schools, they compared all the different test scores, they, you know, they had their child visit different schools and see what the child thought and so forth. So I think that the school choice process was pretty complicated and that many of the parents, I think, were engaged in ways that are maybe more sophisticated or nuanced than what we know in the existing research.
I was struck by this, that, you know, some parents were looking to have their kids experience a school with a diverse population, but definitions of diversity varied not just among the parents, but among the children as well. What are some of the examples of what you heard there?
So often the word diversity gets used without, you know, a real concrete sense of what someone means when they use it. And so, for example, I would be talking about race with parents, and then suddenly we would be talking about sexuality and talking about, you know, the lesbian couple that lives down the street and, you know, and sort of getting into how their children are watching television programs that are, you know, challenging homophobia. And I thought that was really interesting and important, but it was ultimately, you know, this sort of shift away from talking about race. And I think these are some of the strategies that white people, at least in the study, used to kind of, you know, sort of sidestep some of my really intense questions that I had to then come back at from a different angle.
Were the kids even able to define the word race in any sort of adequate way?
So there was variation, and I think that's one of the important lessons of my research, is that not all of these children are thinking about race or even defining race in the same way. Some of the kids actually told me that because racism didn't exist anymore, that you weren't even allowed to use the phrase "that's racist" at their school. And so they were, you know, they told me that there could never possibly even be racism at their school, and they weren't allowed to use that word. So that was very different, of course, than the kids who were attending the more racially diverse school with parents who were talking more openly about oppression and inequality.
Let's go back to some phone calls. And Don from Kansas City, Missouri. Don, you're on Up to Date. We're talking again about how white kids learn about race. Good morning.
Good morning. My question has to do, my daughter, her two best friends are African American. However, their families are both upper middle class as we are. And how much does class make a distinction in this whole conversation?
Interesting question, Don. How about class, Margaret?
Yeah, that's a really great question, Don. Thank you. I think that as a sociologist, I obviously am interested in this book, you know, in terms of how race and class work together. And in this context, I'm looking at, you know, how whiteness and upper middle class work together. But certainly, you know, we know in our society there are multiple systems of oppression at play, multiple different ways that people are divided. And so I think that looking at, that would be a really great study to look at, you know, how someone like your daughter would be thinking about race, given her relationships with close friends who share her class background but don't share her race background. And that, again, that would be a really interesting area of further inquiry for sure.
You know, do the white kids learn to justify their privilege somehow, Margaret?
I think that for some of them they do. I mean, I think that, you know, saying, well, I'm really smart and I have to go to the special school because I'm really smart, and now I have a better education, you know, and it's not because I'm white. It's not because I'm, you know, my parents are rich. It's because I'm smart. And, you know, that's sort of a justification. And you know, that child very well may be smart. But, you know, the sort of denial of the real opportunities and advantages that not all kids have. I mean, you know, so I think that, yeah, I think there were some strategies that the kids were developing and that even their parents were helping them develop to sort of justify the unequal opportunities that they were being given. And so forth.
Well, ultimately, were the white kids, are they more aware of class inequality than overt racism? Did you see that?
Again, there was a lot of variation. I mean, Certainly the kids did talk about class dynamics, and certainly some of the kids talked about you know, families that lived out in the country and sort of this rural white sort of idea. And so I think that was another way that race and class were kind of coming together, but thinking about whiteness in terms of, you know, working class folks or things, or, you know, other groups that were not them. But they also talked a lot about gender. I mean, the kids had a lot to say, and it's complicated and very nuanced. But I think my overall answer is there was variation.
How articulate were they at that age, 10 to 13?
I was honestly very impressed with them. I mean, some of the kids were so incredibly thoughtful. And there was one boy who told me that he liked to read the newspaper before school every day so he could go and argue with his teacher. He didn't like very much. So, you know, there was some really, really, really thoughtful kids. And I was generally like, I was really impressed with how articulate they were.
I like to get some of my college students to read the newspaper before they come to my journalism class some days, Margaret, just for the record here. Kelly from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Good morning. I was just wondering if Margaret could speak to when she said how white parents pass on the privilege. I felt like I was also hearing they shouldn't try to advocate for the best for their kids. And I'm wondering if I misunderstood or if she could speak to that.
Yeah, this whole question of passing on privilege and how parents can avoid that, if that's the concern, Margaret.
So that's a really great question, and it absolutely is sort of one of the major conclusions of my book. And so I think my response would be that, you know, we have this collectively agreed upon idea in our society that being a good parent means providing the best opportunities. And so on the one hand, parents that really value, you know, equality and racial justice and not wanting to participate in the reproduction of inequality, they are faced with what I refer to in the book as the conundrum of privilege, where on the one hand, they want to be a good parent in terms of, you know, giving their kids the best. But on the other hand, they want to be a good citizen and they want to raise kids who will, you know, be part of the movement towards different types of justice and fairness and equality. And so I think that, you know, part of the problem is that parents are living in a structure that's unequal. So for example, if we didn't have such unequal schools, then parents would not be faced with these choices. You know, it wouldn't even be possible for them to choose a better school if all the schools were good. And so I think that part of the challenge is that people are operating at the individual level and making parenting decisions, but they're doing so within a context of structural inequality. And so there's no easy or clear answer other than I think that parents ought to be more thoughtful about that.
I want to stay with that for a moment because you conclude here that white parents can play an important role in challenging the perpetuation of racism and racial inequality in this country only if they're willing to give up some of their own white racial power by rejecting the idea that their own kid is more innocent and deserving than other people's children are. So you're basically saying that in some cases, parents have to conclude that they're going to give their kid maybe what's not best for them for the sake of the greater good of society. Am I reading that right?
You are. And, you know, I know that that comes across as really bizarre to some people. Certainly, I get that. But, you know, I do think that, you know, parents need to understand that all children are worthy of their consideration. I mean, we have all different societies from different time periods and across geography that approach parenting differently, that we don't have to only care about our own child. I think that there are other ways to do this. And I know that again, it might sound strange, but, you know, I think that there are at least moments, you know, maybe not all the time, but there are moments where where, you know, people could think about how a policy at their school, for example, might, you know, hurt a lot of children, even if it benefits their own kid. You know, for example, if you have a situation where your child is having a really negative experience with a teacher and you have the option of pulling that child out of that classroom, you can either pull the child out or you can use your own power as, like, you know, someone whose voice is heard at that school to demand that the classroom is better for all of the kids in that classroom. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there are ways that you can use power to advocate, use your own, you know, your position of power based on, you know, your social position to advocate for more kids than just your own. And I think that's really what I'm pushing for.
Or ultimately the choice of where you send a school, a public school or a private school.
I think you could look at that as well. And certainly I know that's a very contentious debate and there's a lot of different dynamics depending on where you live and the community. But I do think that, yeah, I think that, you know, when being a good citizen conflicts with being a good parent, maybe sometimes, you know, we could choose to be good citizens.
Let's go back to some calls. And Florence from Kansas City, Kansas. Florence, you're on Up to Date.
Yes, good morning, Steve and guest.
Hi, Florence.
I'd like to ask the guest, did she discuss with parents in their conversations about race with their children, how did parents address historical moral aspects of racial justice?
Historical aspects of racial injustice, Margaret.
That's a really great question. And again, I found variation. So some parents, quite frankly, did not know the history of racial injustice or racial justice. And so they were unable to really talk to their children in ways that were historically accurate. One example is one mom told me she was very proud that she used the film The Help to teach her children about race. And of course, that film has been, you know, widely discredited from historians as being, you know, a problematic representation of race in the South, and in domestic work in particular of Black women. And so, you know, that's an example of not knowing the history and then not being able to, you know, teach that history to your children. Whereas other families were much more, you know, I walked into their house and they had stacks of books on the table, mm-hmm. you know, the newest books I was reading, you know, as a graduate student, which is when I did this research, you know, about history and racism and inequality. And so they were taking it upon themselves to really inform themselves. So I think there was a big difference across the parents.
You know, I just want to wrap up. We have about 30 seconds left. You know, 4 years after you went to this town, you went back and talked to some of the kids again. Did you find any to have changed their views on race and racism?
No. In fact, I found that their views in middle school were more cemented when they were in high school. And they were much more passionate and they felt a lot more confident. And ultimately, those views were very polarized.
Were you surprised by that?
I was actually. I didn't think that they would. I was surprised that they became so polarized. I think that was the main surprise.
Well, Margaret Hagerman, her new book, White Kids Growing Up with Privilege in a Racially Divided America. What a provocative topic. What an interesting conversation. Thanks so much for taking some time, Professor. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yesterday, we heard the chilling story of Thomas Nye, the only survivor of an 1856 shipwreck in the North Atlantic. You can hear all about it. Just go to kcur.org/uptodate. Also, you can find us on Twitter. We're at kcuruptodate. Follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Kathleen Pointer. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date. Thank you.